We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So I'm here with Grandmaster Jon Ludvig Hammer, Norway's second highest rated player in the country, world elite, who has been in the top 100, has had an ELO over 2700. So Jon, I really appreciate your coming on here. Thanks for doing this.
I'm happy to be here.
I've been looking to get someone from Norway on, because it's such a chess hotbed right now. We all know one of the primary reasons why is your compatriot Magnus Carlsen. But I obviously want to hear about your chess career, because you've had some amazing accomplishments and you're still a young man. But I also would like to hear about just what it's like in your day-to-day life these days. So what's a typical day like for you?
At the moment, I'm a chess professional, and I have been since March of 2013. So I think just having that opportunity to do chess full time, even when living in what is a reasonably expensive country like Norway, it's unreal, really. My routine is not really, it's very varied. It's not like I have something I do every day. Every day is different. And that's how it's got to be when you're a freelancer and a chess player. You take what assignments or, you know, whatever job you can get, and then there's also chess.
So what changed in 2013? What were you doing prior to that?
I was going to school, studying journalism. And I got an invite to the inaugural Norway Chess. And I said, well, this is a fantastic opportunity. And I dropped out of school to make sure that I could prepare as well as I could for that event. And I scored 1.5 points out of 9. It was pretty horrendous. Naturally, you get some doubts whether you can do chess full time. But just a couple of weeks after that, I got approached by Magnus Carlsen, who asked whether I wanted to be a second for his first world championship match. And after that match, it was broadcasted live on television here in Norway, and it was a huge success. And after that match, I got asked if I wanted to do some TV commentary, because a Norwegian TV channel had seen the World Championship match and thought, well, why only do the championship match, we can do his normal tournaments as well. And just the year of 2013 was amazing for me, because every time I was insecure about what's going to happen next, I just got an opportunity in my lap and took it.
Wow, there's so much I want to dig into from just that what you said so far. So let's start with being Magnus's second. I know you guys are the same age, and I'm sure you cross paths many times over the years. Do you think it was I know you're an elite player, so obviously qualified to be his second, but was there something special about your chess knowledge that you think led him to select you, or was it a comfort level, or what do you think led to your being on his team?
Well, I think it has more to do with what you say, comfort, than chess. I'm a decent player, but I'm nowhere near elite. And also, it's not like I had experience doing this before. There are plenty of people who are 2600 who are fantastic chess seconds. But it was very unorthodox, I thought, to take in a guy who didn't have any previous experience. And I was always hoping that I would get a role. I was also always thinking that I can get kind of be one of the seconds, be kind of the apprentice, a guy kind of just learning the ropes, and hopefully being able to contribute in what I was pretty certain was going to be future world championship matches for Magnus. But as it turns out, he wanted somebody he could trust, and his main second, Peter Heine Nielsen, he was on suspension, I guess you could call it. Basically, they decided that since Peter had switched from Anand to Magnus, he would not be participating in the first world championship match. So instead of being the apprentice, I became the kind of head second, the coordinating second, who was the one communicating with the other seconds and then kind of summarizing everything and being the one to convey our ideas and our thoughts to Magnus.
So you were basically, Magnus would give instructions to you and then you would delegate from there?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And were you involved in the chess on top of that? Like, would you be assigned certain openings?
Sure, for sure.
So would you be assigned certain openings or certain players, or how does it work? I guess this is the world championship, so you know the player. But.
Yeah. It was an experience for me, of course. I wasn't sure what the job was myself. And that kind of makes you able to decide what the job is. And when you delegate, you kind of think that the guys you have certain expertises. It was myself, Laurent Fresinet, and Pavel Elianov. Basically we would talk to each other and say, well, we need to cover this, this, and this. You know this stuff, so you'll take that. You'll do this stuff, and I'll do that. It's not a dictatorship by any means. It's a collaborative effort.
And were you guys all in Oslo or doing this online? Or how did you arrange that?
We were not in Chennai, which was very unusual. But I'm not going to go into where we were.
Even 3 years later, it's still a secret.
I'm not sure.
But. Yeah, I understand. You don't want to reveal anything that isn't other people
well,
don't want to reveal.
I can say that the last two world championship matches, the team has been located at the Kragerø Resort in Norway, and that's no secret.
Okay. So talking, you also mentioned that you've been doing some TV commentating. Was that a hard transition for a chess player to suddenly be speaking into a microphone in front of legions of fans?
Well, it's strange, right? Because up until the World Championship match, even 2 weeks before the World Championship match, if somebody told me that chess was going to be a huge televised sport in Norway, I wouldn't believe them. At the very last hour, the state broadcaster came together and decided we're going to go for this first inaugural Carlsen World Championship match, and we're going to put a lot of resources into it, and we're going to make it into a great show. And it was a huge success. And I think for Norwegian chess, that is the big moment. And it's kind of strange because a lot of people have been talking about the Magnus effect ever since he became the world's youngest grandmaster. But it was only 10 years later when he played the world championship match, we really saw the game being very popular amongst everyone, everyone in Norway, and also it was only then we saw an increase in membership numbers in the Norwegian Chess Federation. To be honest, we don't have that many members, and certainly we didn't have very many members even when Carlsen became world number one. But this television, it has a whole other way of getting through to people, I think, and it just it has been a game changer for Norwegian chess.
Television is the opiate of the masses, right?
Something like that, yeah.
So are you getting stopped on the streets now these days?
Sometimes, yeah.
That must be a good feeling.
It's strange. But yeah, no, it says something about the position chess has gotten in Norway. And I think to foreigners, it's difficult to comprehend. And I think it's beyond, it's certainly beyond what it is in Russia now. And I know that Russia has these enormous chess traditions, but having televised chess tournaments regularly, I'm not sure that they were ever at that stage. I think at the moment, Norway is unique amongst chess infiltrating the what's normal.
Yeah, reminiscent of the Fischer boom in the U.S., I guess, way back when. But it's hard to gauge across cultures and history how large each one
was. Yeah, I mean, I should shut up, right? Because I'm way too young to know anything about Fischer, what Russia was really like, the chess tradition there. But
yeah, even I'm too young, so I couldn't tell you either.
Yeah, and for me, it's unreal.
Yeah.
But so, it's fantastic. Think the timing of being a very good chess player at this moment, it feels very lucky.
Well, it's good that you appreciate that, but this is a podcast for chess fans, and I feel, and I think the audience certainly feels, that if you've been in the top 100 in the world and you're number two in the country, in your country, you should be able to make a good living in chess. So one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is just to get a sense for what it's like and get a sense for what's replicable and what's not about it. But unfortunately, there's only one Magnus, right?
Yeah, but one is enough, at least for the boom in Norway.
So just to get a little more sense for your fame, how often do you get recognized? I feel like
sporadically.
So once a week or something, once a month?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. And so you're doing your chess announcing, you're competing. How do you decide when to do which?
Well, I mean, you jump on the opportunities you have. And in order to do chess professionally, you have to be a bit cynical about choosing the events which maximize your profit. I mean, you can say that a guy in the world top 100 should be able to live off chess, but that's not really how it works. Even for a guy in the top 40, top 30, I think it can be difficult living from chess, kind of depending on where you live. I mean, if you live in Moscow, it's one of the most expensive cities in the world, right? Norway is infamous, but also other big cities like London and Paris, it's not going to be automatic that you can make a good living and still kind of live in the let's say fancy places.
Yeah, I don't know what the living is like in Russia with top 100 players. I mean, I do get the sense that there's, at least historically, has been more state sponsorship. So you said that
I assume that Russian chess players are getting on pretty well, but I do also know that whilst Russia might not be the richest country, certainly there are places in especially kind of Moscow, maybe that you know, there's it goes very quickly from being cheap to expensive.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when you're not doing announcing, are you training frequently these days?
No. Well, I'll be honest. It's my training is motivationally based. So I train when I have motivation, when I have spare time. Right now, I haven't had any of either. So training hasn't been fantastic. But I'm trying to find some very good tournaments to set myself good goals for the year, and then it's easier to be motivated for working when you have something you're working towards.
And a player of your level, when you do sit down to train, is it primarily opening and engine based, or are you still working on other aspects of the game as well?
Yeah, no, it's mostly openings and using the engine, which is really, it's about efficiency, I guess. It's just so much easier to sit with the computer than actually do hands-on work, sitting down with the board and thinking for yourself. But I certainly see that there are other things you train by doing it, the let's say proper way, and I try to do that. It's just that it's so much easier to sit down with the computer and do stuff.
Yeah, my recent guest Simon Williams, we were talking about the same thing. I think that's something all chess players can relate to, and I think that you're probably just old enough where you probably had to read a few chess books in your ascent.
For sure.
But now I think you can, you know, these crazy talented young kids don't even necessarily need to read that many books.
Yeah, and I get on their backs about it because I'm telling them you need to read more. I mean, you cannot just sit there watching this DVD in the background because it's not, you're not focusing properly. You're just dozing off with it in the background. And I read a lot of books and I kept that kind of, when you have a habit, you keep to that, right? So I have, in my life, I have watched one chess DVD and that's it.
Which one?
It was Anand, My Best Games.
Oh, wow. That sounds, I haven't seen it. How was it?
I thought it was pretty good, but to be honest, I didn't. Yeah, somehow books works better for me, but I guess it's the force of habit.
And I saw, we'll get to this in a minute. I watched a little bit of your chess.com streaming video, and you mentioned that Seven Deadly Chess Sins is your favorite chess book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites as well. So I was curious which chess sin you've struggled with the most that Jonathan Rosen mentions. There's thinking, blinking, wanting, materialism, egoism, perfectionism, and looseness.
I think it's blinking. I don't know. So I very much relate to what he writes about trends, that there can be trends in a chess game. And even if you are better, if the trend is going against you, kind of going from being much better to just slightly better, it's very easy to lose control over the game. And sort of get stuck in the trend rather than the objective value of the position right now. Because it's human nature. It's difficult to shake off the feeling that if you had chosen with hindsight this move instead of that move, you would have been winning instantly, or, you know, just, and that kind of, that annoys you, and it kind of sticks with you, and it's tough to shake off. Every chess player knows you're supposed to think about the position in front of you, but there's no chess player in the world who hasn't once or twice, or in my case, 100 times, started thinking about calculating other lines that could have occurred now that you realize your choice wasn't the best one.
Do you have any standout memorable games where that happened to you? Like traumatic, you might say?
No, not that I recall. Not any so traumatic I'm able to mention it when being
interviewed. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't want to give your potential opponents any ammunition either. So.
No, I mean there are plenty of frustrating games. The one who comes to mind first is my game from Norway Chess 2015. When I got a second chance, even after my 1.5 point initial start, and I was white against Topalov, and I played a very good opening. I got a fantastic position, and then I sacrificed a piece, thinking I could create a very dangerous attack. And it's uncharacteristic of my style, but I really felt like I was playing on the big stage and I wanted to play aggressive chess and I wanted to show people that I had something to contribute at this level. And what happened was that my fantastic attack somehow faded. And then it became a long ending, where I was in trouble. And I ended up actually defending that ending up until the point where I made the worst mistake ever. I thought he had to play a different move, and then I had my move ready. And when he didn't play the move I was expecting, I played my move anyway, some kind of brain malfunction. And I had to resign on the next move in what should have been a draw.
Well, I think every chess player will be able to relate to that story, although most of us won't have anyone to impress with our games, although we may delusionally think that we do. Do you have any wins that are especially memorable to you or turning points in your playing career?
Well, I mean, I beat Magnus when he was world champion.
Yes.
I think such a question. I mean, if you don't answer that, you should just quit chess, right?
Right. I wasn't sure about bringing it up because I feel like you probably every time you're interviewed, you're asked to talk about it. But on the other hand, obviously, that's an incredible accomplishment to tell your grandkids about. Someday.
Yeah, no, I agree that Magnus wasn't at his best, and to be honest, I don't think I was at my best. But I beat the world champion, and that's something people understand very easily.
Right.
I beat the world champion. And it's something that's going to stick with you for the rest of your life.
How many times have you guys played over the years in tournaments?
In tournaments?
Yeah.
Including Rapid?
Sure.
Probably 15, maybe.
Okay, and when
a lot of that was when we were younger.
Yeah, so you guys, were you the same exact same age or 1 year apart?
The same age.
Wow. So you must have had an interesting upbringing in the fact that you are an extraordinary talent in chess, but Magnus has turned out even better. So was there a moment that you realized that this guy might be world champion? Or was it just obvious from the beginning?
No, actually, I was one of those people who thought, well, surely this cannot last. I mean, he was going up to 2700. We went to the same high school. Simen Agdestein has a chess program at a Norwegian top athletes high school. And we both attended that program. And even when he was there, he was like very young, 16, 17, 18, 2750. And even then, I wasn't sure, kind of, yeah, I mean, he's a fantastic chess player. But I mean, surely, I mean, he's up against Kramnik, and he's up against Anand, and he's up against all of these legends. Surely they will knock some sense into him. No, they did not. I mean, he was just a different level
Yep.
the whole way.
Part of that I think might be due to his unique style. I remember someone I can't remember, so I don't want to misspeak about where I read this, but some grandmaster saying they reviewed a game with him and it's not his calculation that separates him from the other players. Was that your experience as well?
Well, I mean, it's certainly true. He has a feeling for the game that is just stunning. I cannot pinpoint the exact moment I realized that. Yeah, I think he's the greatest chess player ever.
So, getting back to the Norwegian College of Elite Sport where you studied, I saw your tweet where you mentioned that the entire Norway Olympiad team has trained there. So, I was curious, what are they putting in the water there? What is Simon Agdestein doing to produce such an amazing, steady stream of chess players?
I think it's community. It's a lot of talented youngsters who wants to become better, and they're pushing each other. It's a culture for training chess, for competing with your friends, but also having friends, having sort of your closest friends at the school who has an interest in the same thing as you. And I think just that community he has created is a big part of the success. You cannot become a good player without working hard. And what happens when you have a good community is that everyone pushes themselves, partially because they want to be better than their friends, and partially because they learn from their friends and from kind of from Seaman, of course. I mean, Seaman is one of the most creative chess players there is, and I think it's just, yeah, no, I think community is a big part of the answer. You don't necessarily have to have some fantastic coach that is very disciplined and kind of demands a lot of their students. This is based on their own motivation for getting better.
That makes sense. So getting back to you mentioned you studied journalism. What led you to choose to study journalism?
In my naivete, I thought journalism was broken,
I don't know if
and
that's
I
not,
thought,
I wouldn't call that naive.
yeah, no, but I mean, I thought I could fix it.
Oh, that, yeah,
That
okay.
was the naive part.
Right.
I started studying journalism and thought, well, if you at some point down the line you get into a position of power, you can tell people that, this is not the way to do things. And now, I ended up doing a lot of, well, basically, I during the World Championship match, I was working for a Norwegian media company, VG, and basically they are very tabloid, and they don't hide it. They don't pretend to be something they're not. And we were doing some shows from New York, and we were discussing amongst each other, and people were asking, oh yeah, well, you studied journalism, Jon Ludvig, and I responded, yeah, I studied journalism, but I ended up here with you. So yeah, I'm done trying to change the world. It turns out that's really hard work.
Yeah, well, you can change a few people's lives through chess. So when you do your announcing, I imagine you have to cater the announcement to a fairly, I don't know, beginner to intermediate level of chess. Is that how you approach it?
That is certainly the goal. Doing it any differently would be a huge mistake. The fact is that most people are chess beginners, and those are the people we want to watch the show. And then we need to cater to them. And what has been the most amazing about chess in Norway is that the amount of positive feedback we get from people who don't really know any chess at all. They just think it's a great show and entertaining, and they feel like they understand what's going on. And that is the best compliment we can get.
That's great. So how is it presented? Is there here in the States, and when they show sports or chess, there's basically a play-by-play person and a color commentator. The color commentator would most likely be someone like you, a true expert of the game. Is that how it's presented in Norway?
Mostly what has been is that there are two experts and one host. So with your terms, it would be two of the two guys who knows really what's going on.
The color commentator.
And then, yeah, and one guy who kind of fills the void. And I think it has worked very well.
So is it a challenge for you to explain things at the beginner level?
Yeah, I think it's difficult, but I think a lot of people have said that the worse that it's kind of in order to do a television commentary, maybe you should not be that strong a player in order to kind of be more familiar with the audience you're trying to present to. And that, I think, is just completely wrong. Because what you need is somebody who is able to convey the chess the way so that people can understand. That's going to be crucial. But I don't think that depends on their chess level. Actually, I think the stronger a chess player, the better. Because there are intricacies in chess that a 2650 player can spot and explain to the public, which maybe a 22 or 2400 player would not be able to. So being able to relay and being able to explain to your audience, that's going to be crucial. But the stronger the player having those abilities, the better.
Yeah, in a sense, you can see around corners. You probably have a better sense of when the key moments are coming than someone like me would.
Yeah, I think so. And also kind of understanding what goes on in the player's mind. Because what goes on in a player's mind isn't always what the computers say. And of course, I'm very dependent on the computer myself. I'm trying to commentate while kind of keeping chatter on the whole time. I don't have time to concentrate really on the game and analyzing and calculating possible lines. I'm dependent on the computer, but I have the advantage of a pretty good instinct. So I can guess what's going on in a player's mind better than most people.
That's interesting, because I know that some commentators keep the engine off. So you have it on when you do your broadcasting?
For sure. I think most people do, but some people are reluctant to admit it.
Oh, wow. Because I know that I think Jan and Peter Svidler don't use the engine, because I've seen them. I've seen moments where they want to check it. But have you tried announcing without an engine?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, most of the stuff I do is without, but I'm always gonna check it periodically in order kind of just to. It's bad TV if there's a moment in which one of the players can win if they find the right move and we're not aware of it.
Right.
I mean, that is, you can build so much drama out of that moment that you need to know that moment exists.
That's a really good point. So you mentioned that you've been too busy to study lately. I know you've got the Pro Chess League going on right now. What else is keeping you busy?
Accounting. it's a new year. Stuff for 2016 needs to be filled out.
That's funny.
Starting tomorrow, I'm doing text commentary for the Tata Steel tournament.
Oh, that should be fun.
Yeah. So, no, there's different things going on.
By text commentary, you mean writing about it?
Yeah.
Okay. And how was your, as we record this, today is Friday. You played in the Pro Chess League on Wednesday. It will be...
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it will be released. So how was your experience in the first round of the Pro Chess League?
I think it's an innovative concept. I know some of the guys at Chess.com very well for many, many years. And I wanted to be a part of it. And the chess community in Oslo is fantastic, much thanks to Siemens Chess School. So we got a team together. We had a very bad first week, but we're going to come back stronger.
Nice. Did you guys play in the same room or did you just play from home?
Yeah, we tried playing from home for the first time. We're looking into playing at the same venue, and I'm a bit concerned about the guys being done disturbing the guys still playing, but we'll definitely think about it.
And who do you play next?
We're playing Johannesburg. Okay. So that's a game we really need a match we need to win in order to still stay in the running.
And are you preparing for your opponents for this? Do you have a sense yet if you'll be putting work in or just relying on?
I didn't prepare anything for the first match, and that didn't turn out fantastic, although I had winning positions in almost every opening. So something needs to be done, and I think we as a team agree that the performance against Riga was not something we want to be known for.
And I just have a couple more topics I want to hit on. One, of course, is the World Championship. We're recording this a couple months after it's ended. You weren't on the team this time, is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I was a part of VG, Norwegian Papers, broadcast, TV broadcast, actually, of the event. Originally, they were supposed to have it in New York. So I was very tempted to kind of be at my very first World Chess Championship match in one of the most spectacular places in the world. But unfortunately, those plans kind of, they fell apart. So instead, it became a TV broadcast from Arsenal.
Did you enjoy more being a second or broadcasting?
In general, I can say that broadcasting is much less tense. I mean, being a second is very hard work, and you kind of feel every time your opening is being played, you kind of feel some responsibility. You're nervous about whether or not there's something you've missed, whether or not you are going to be the reason Magnus loses out on his title. It's a lot of pressure. It's actually a very difficult question. I would actually say I enjoyed being a second more than I enjoyed the broadcasting of the World Championship match.
Okay, but it sounds from your answer, basically you'd be happy to do both.
I'm one of those guys who's lucky enough to have two great options.
Yes. Well deserved, I think. So what do you have coming up the next couple months? You're about to be writing about Tata Steel. What's after that?
Actually, it's not clear. I've been taking a break from chess the past couple of months. I had horrendous results during 2016. And so I'm kind of taking a time out and trying to get back stronger later. I'm hoping there will be a qualifier for the Norway chess tournament. If there is, I'm definitely participating there. And that's going to kind of be my goal to qualify for Norway Chess 2017.
So would that be the Norway National Championship?
No, that would be the top tournament with Carlsen, with who signed up? I think it's Anand.
Oh, wow.
Okay. It's basically top 10 guys in the world.
So you mentioned that you've been in a slump. Do you have a sense of what has contributed to it?
I'm a bit insecure, but every time I've played chess, as you said, I was 2,700, and now 12 months later, I'm not, let's say. When things are not going your way, that's always very hard. And changing that trend is tough because it's a vicious circle. It's not only that you lose rating and you lose kind of confidence. It's also that when you lose confidence, you don't play as well the next time round, and it kind of reinforces itself. I think I have been poor in my sleeping habits during tournaments. I'm going to be very vigilant about getting enough sleep for my next tournaments. But for that to account for the 75 lost rating points, I think probably not. So there's something that's gone wrong, and I don't really know what.
And does it impact your daily mood? Like, if you don't have a tournament, are you thinking about it constantly, or are you able to put it aside and just live your life?
Well, it affects my mood when at tournaments, and it affects my kind of motivation for more tournaments. In general, when you're losing, it reinforces kind of bad confidence and so on, and you lose more. But on the other hand, if you're winning, you just get more confident, and you kind of I'm a streaky player, so I just need to turn the streak.
So this is an unusual for you in your chess career to have good streaks and bad streaks?
No, I think that has occurred quite a bit. It's not a great habit, but on the other hand, it means that the successes are very great and the failures ditto. And if you are the kind of person who can remember the highlights, it's nice, like we spoke about, right?
Right.
Beating the world champion, that's a nice highlight.
Yeah, and you're certainly not alone at the top level. People like Ivanchuk and Topalov come to mind as players who have their ups and downs, but when it's all said and done, they're amazing players.
Yeah, I'm not going to compare myself to those two. That would be a bit too much, I think.
Well, you can be a similarly streaky player, even if you're like, you know, tiny notch below them. But obviously, you're, you know, an incredible player in your own right. So last but not least, I wanted to get into pop culture a little bit. I saw on your chess.com streamer, you said that you refused to reveal what kind of music you listened to. You said it was too embarrassing. So I felt, I'm not a real journalist, but nonetheless, I felt it my journalistic duty to ask you about that.
Yeah, no, but actually, since then, I've gotten some good feedback from a guy who's a freelancer who also does some songwriting. And he thought that the one, we were switching, choosing the tracks, and he thought my track choice was very interesting.
Oh, nice.
So now I'm going to be brave and tell you that one of my favorites at the moment is Marina and the Diamonds and the song Savages is very good.
Okay, I'm going to check that out. I'm not familiar with it, but I'll make a note. What else do you do to relax?
I watch a lot of TV shows, which I believe I have in common with a lot of professional chess players, basically just treading time. You'd think that if we were a bit more disciplined, the things we could do would be just amazing.
Well, the brain needs to recuperate as well. Any recommended TV shows before we go? Especially Norwegian. I think it would be nice to hear a recommendation of your favorite Norwegian TV show.
I don't watch too many Norwegian TV shows, but I hear that we're doing huge success internationally right now with the Skam, Shame,
okay,
TV show, which is very... It's the setup, the format is pretty unusual, and I hear it's spreading around the globe. It's a kind of teenage drama, which seems to a lot of people recognize themselves in it, even if they their teenage years are behind them.
So it sounds reminiscent of Freaks and Geeks or something like that, but. Yeah, those always resonate, Friday Night Lights, shows like that. Okay, well, I don't have any more questions. Yoon, I really appreciate your time. I think people are going to really enjoy this. You've really given some insight into things, a look behind the curtain at things that very few chess players get to actually live. So thanks very much. If people want to reach you, what's the best way to do it?
Email, really?
Okay, and I know you're on Twitter as well, so people can look up.
Well, I mean, yeah, Twitter, Facebook page. You can write a message to my Facebook page.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, and good luck with your writing and then your playing later in the year.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to Perpetual Chess. To hear more episodes, give feedback, or suggest guests, go to perpetualchesspod.com. If you like the show, please help me out by telling your friends and giving me a high rating on iTunes. I'll be back next week with another episode of the Perpetual Chess Podcast.
Sports Social Podcast Network.